DeMelo Roberts Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. Daniel H. Wilson is a Cherokee citizen and Portland author of about 7 novels or so, including the New York Times bestseller Robopocalypse, as well as 5 nonfiction books and several short stories and graphic novels. He's got a PhD in robotics from Carnegie Mellon University. His newest book, Hole in the Sky, was recently chosen by Scientific American magazine as a best pick for 2025. And it's just been picked up by Netflix to be adapted into a film. We're going to talk about that a little bit today. And he's my guest, Daniel H. Wilson. Welcome to Stage and Studio on Arts Watch.
Hi, Dime. Thanks for having me.
It's great to meet you. I finished your book. It was quite an easy read for me, although I was worried about all the characters. I'm a science fiction fan, so as soon as I heard about your book, I heard about you, I just went, I've got to talk to you. So I'm so glad you made the time today. A Hole in the Sky is a Native First Contact alien invasion story. Now, that's just a very short teaser.
Sure.
It's also an indigenous science fiction book that references some of the history of the peoples, which I found really fascinating, around 800 to 1450 AD, who inhabited the Spiral Mounds in Oklahoma before the European invasion. But that's just a little short summary. Daniel, tell us about the Spiral Mounds and what they mean to you.
Sure. Yeah. So the Spiral Mounds have always kind of been part of my life. So I grew up in the Cherokee Nation, and which overlaps with North Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so I spent my summers out at my grandparents' farm, which was our original Indian allotment after forced removal. And it was out in northeastern Oklahoma, and it was real close to Spiro and Spiro Mounds. And so the mound builder civilization is just has always been fascinating to me because it's so ancient. You know, it's a precursor civilization before a lot of the tribes that we know today, including the Cherokee. And of course, the Cherokee aren't from that area, right? But what I found was that, you know, when I started researching the mound builder civilization, and in particular Spiro, and of course, going there and walking the mounds and having that always have been part of my childhood, I started realizing that there are a lot of similarities and similar stories and similar ceremony between the mound builders and the Cherokee. And so it's just this ancient, mysterious place. I think of it as the basically our equivalent of the Egyptian pyramids in North America. And it's just right there. And so the mound builders were everywhere, though. I mean, they spread out all across what's now the eastern United States. And so there are lots of mounds all over the place. And many, many of them have been lost because they were always pretty much in really great places to build cities. So on purpose. And so, yeah, they've just been part of my childhood for a long time.
Well, it's really great that you incorporated that into your novel. You know, this is just a side note, but my dad's side of the family lived their lives in Tahlequah, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the capital of the Cherokee Nation.
Exactly. And so, but I never heard about the Spiro Mounds. I was so thrilled to read about it and do a little bit more research about it. But you have very deep ties to Oklahoma.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up there, and then it's like a couple hours away is where I would spend my summers out. But I mean, it's all the same thing. And so it's a really unique place. I mean, so a lot of stuff I write is science fiction, robots and aliens and everything, but there's also usually a lot of native characters. Because I grew up in this really special place where in Oklahoma, it was Indian territory where a lot of tribes were forced marched and relocated there. And so there's a lot of native people there just always, and a lot of sovereign tribes. So like tribes that have sovereignty over their area. So they have, you know, their own driver's licenses and hospitals and license plates and things like that. And so it's always just been, it's just been a fun place to explore in my work. And so it's a lot of natives and robots.
Yeah, and there were a lot of both, definitely. I haven't read all of your other books, but have you written indigenous native characters in most of your books?
Absolutely. You know, my book that broke out was called Robopocalypse. It's a novel, my first novel that I wrote. And it takes place in the Osage Nation, and it's about robots attacking. And basically, the Osage Nation has got this really cool thing where they have these 3 villages where everybody that's Osage knows that if there's a problem, you go back to Gray Horse, you go back to the 3 villages. And so it made a ton of sense if robots attacked that people would go there and that they would find electricity and, like, you know, like civilization. And so that whole book is about Osage people fighting robots. And I was sort of very disappointed when Killers of the Flower Moon came out. And they, you know, Scorsese went back to the Osage Nation to shoot that historical, that real bummer. I mean, you know what happens. It's not going to be a great story for the Osage. I was really looking forward to having a movie shot out there where Native people got to fight robots in the future instead of, you know, revisiting sort of these historical moments that we all kind of know how they play out. So, but what are you going to do? So yeah, I spent a lot of time there.
I think it would be very therapeutic to fight robots and win.
I write Native characters in the future. I don't do a lot of Native characters in the past. So I'm writing science fiction and it's kind of, in a way, I feel like I'm writing in a genre that's all about the future with voices that have been kind of relegated to the past. So it's really nice to be able to do that. But then again, I mean, these are just regular people. It isn't like they're in these books for any particular reason. It's just that this takes place in Oklahoma and these are people that live in Oklahoma.
Well, I think those are the best characters, the everyday people. And at the heart of this, it's science fiction, but I also want to call it science-based novel. Because you have such a strong history with science and robotics. The heart of it is the Native father and his rocky relationship with his teenage daughter. So it's Jim and Tawny. And they are such an important part of saving the earth. I don't want to give any spoilers away. But those are two characters that everyone could relate to as far as, especially parents, I would think, and the difficulty of connecting with a teenage child. What was your inspiration for these characters?
Well, look, I have a teenager, first of all. So I'm going through that. I'm doing my therapy by writing these characters. And hey, look, the kid comes around, all right? I don't want to spoil it, but you know, the dad ends up, you know, winning the respect of the teenager. Maybe that's a little bit of my own wishes going in there. But you know, I was coming off of my last novel, worked with Michael Crichton's estate, and I wrote a sequel to The Andromeda Strain. So I pitched them this idea. I've always loved that book, but it is a super technical techno thriller, right? And look, the problem is caused by science. The solution comes from science, and it's just science, science, science. And I love that. That's really great, but it doesn't leave a lot of room for humanity sometimes. And so for this novel, I leaned into all my science background. Obviously, I always do. I do a lot of world building, but I wanted to kind of take the reader on an alternate route into a place where a different sort of framework for understanding how the world works, besides maybe a Western perspective, like on science and technology, was going to be a major part of the novel. And so that's what Jim and Tawny represent, but they also really represent the humanity of the novel. And they're just a broken family. They're trying to heal. And there's this crazy stuff happening. And it gives them this opportunity where they're thrown together in this crucible. And you get to see how they, you know, how they sink or swim in that way. So, I mean, when the aliens show up, you know, it gets pretty intense. But the aliens show up in Spyro. You know, they show up right in their backyard. And so in a lot of ways, you know, they're the folks that live there with that and have always lived there with that. And so they're the experts in that way.
I think I read something where you are saying that they were used to things that they can't control more than some of the other characters, that they, you know, they're used to having uncertainty in their lives.
Yeah, you know, thematically, that was one thing I played with, because aliens showing up, I mean, first of all, it's something that incredibly we are worried about now, for real. Like, there's actual articles and, you know, there's really UAPs and things like that. But I feel like there's sort of different ways to react to that kind of knowledge. And they're all part of me, you know. So I used to be a scientist, and a scientist wants to understand that kind of stuff, even if it's maybe you shouldn't. Maybe it's too big of an idea, or it's something that you shouldn't know. I did some consulting, some contract work for the military. I've seen their perspective on it, which is, in particular, the Air Force, which is, you know, let's destroy it. Like, this is a threat. They see the unknown as a threat. A scientist wants to figure out the unknown. And then there's also the perspective of just living with the unknown and sort of being okay with it being there and not necessarily having to destroy it or run away from it. Just kind of acknowledging that the unknown is a part of everything, of our reality, and that it's there whether you like it or not. And you don't necessarily have to lose your mind over it or try to beat it or figure it out or control it. Yeah, exactly.
Or dominate it. Yeah. For our listeners, UAP is unidentified anomalous phenomena, which is a lot harder than saying UFO.
Yeah, I know. I think they changed it like that on purpose, right?
I know. It made it sound more scientific, I guess. You know?
Maybe.
No. But there are some other characters that one who really embraces mm-hmm. what is happening and becomes such, I guess, morphed into what is happening.
Yeah.
A young Black female scientist. She becomes drawn, Michaela, who is drawn into these alien forces. And another one is a CIA weapons expert who I read that you described as a square jaw hero type.
Yeah.
And they're very different. They're like opposing viewpoints. One works for NASA, the other one for the CIA. What do these characters or these different storylines say to you? What do they represent?
Yeah, well, I mean, so Michaela, she, you know, I spent a lot of time in graduate school and around scientists. And there's this really interesting sort of comfort that's this pursuit of knowledge, right? And it allows you kind of to ignore human beings to some extent, because they can be really messy and they can really hurt your feelings. And so I think a lot of times there's this goal to just pursue knowledge, you know, and there's a purity to it. But there's also this risk, you know, where you forget the important parts of being a person, right? Like I've become a parent, I'm married. Like I've started out very logical as a scientific kid who was obsessed with just reading science fiction. But over the years, I realized like, you know, for me personally, in my experience embodied as a human, I really value my kids. I mean, it's a life-changing thing for me. And so you kind of can't have that if you dissociate from humanity. And that's kind of what Michaela's doing, because she hasn't had the experience she wants to have with people for a variety of reasons. And as a result, she's chosen to go as hard as she can for the unknown. And it manifests for her physically in that the deeper she gets into this sticky sort of into this interactions with this entity, the more humanity she loses and the more she starts to become the science that she sort of idolizes. And ultimately it's with her, it's a question of sort of like, you know, do we look into the face of God? Like, do we look into the creator's furnace? And if we do, what happens to us? Is it worth it? And then Gavin, he is more of a by the books guy. And part of that is like, I love that stuff. He's got a Delta team. He's in a Chinook Special Forces helicopter with Nighthawk. And I love that stuff. Like, that's more traditional techno thriller stuff. And you know, doing research, interviewing soldiers, interviewing pilots, astronauts. I love all that stuff. And so he really represents that sort of front-facing government response, which, by the way, is as accurate as I could make it. There really are people in the government whose job it is to investigate these things. And so I base it all on that, on those people. Yeah, so he's used to having the answers. This is the guy who is not only, actually, I got invited to go speak at West Point, Military Academy at West Point, right? And I thought I was pretty hot stuff because I got into Carnegie Mellon. I was very proud of myself back then because it's very hard to get in.
Well, you should be.
Yeah, but here's the deal. I had to do a lot of academic stuff to get in to there and then to succeed there. But when I got to West Point, I realized these guys have to do all that and they have to do push-ups. they have to be able to run and like lift things. And I'm like, wait, what? Both? I mean, who can do both? That's too much. So anyway, this is Gavin. He's got it all. And so in any other movie, this is the guy who saves the day. But, you know, this isn't necessarily that book or that story. And so part of his journey is coming to terms with the fact that he's out of his depth and that this this particular story wasn't built for him to, you know, ride off on a horse with the princess.
Yeah, I like that he isn't the main protagonist in this at all. That's pretty clear as he gets more and more overwhelmed. There's a fourth storyline. I think, is that one, two, three? Yeah, four storylines. And this is a mysterious character. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't quite get a hold of who this was, but it was somebody who I found fascinating because this person is the only one who can really decipher the alien communications. And the alien communications, or at least the interpretation of it, read like poetry to me.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going for. By the way, that was one of the main notes from my editor was like, you got to cut down on the poetry, Daniel. You're indulging yourself here.
I liked it.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Yeah, so there's a character called the Man Downstairs, and he's just sort of a He's a secret operative. He's a guy who created an AI algorithm that, as training data for input, it took all these, he put in all these random data sources, but the one thing that he shouldn't have done is he put his own heartbeat from like a Fitbit type device as one of the inputs. And so this thing, at some point in the past, it predicted the future, or it intercepted like some communications, and the government got interested in it. And so that's the story of the man downstairs. He's a guy who lives in a super secret lab. He has to be there. He has to keep his Fitbit on, or the government will kill him. And his crazy, super sensitive, weird quantum AI starts picking up on the thoughts of the entity. And so he's the one who's sort of down there almost talking to it, or sort of receiving its messages. And I really use that character as part of the framework, a narrative structure so that we can check in with the entity, kind of like, because it doesn't communicate in any sort of traditional way. And this is as close as we get, or these strange poetic sort of ramblings that come out of this chatbot that's trying to make sense of what it's picking up. And, you know, it really represents, again, that's all based on science. So like, it's really this area of sort of quantum stuff when things get spooky, right? Like stuff like entanglement, stuff like, oh Jesus, it's called retrocausality. The idea that things in the future can affect things that are happening now, which by the way is completely consistent with a lot of native beliefs where people believe that things that happen later can affect what's going on now. So yeah, so I really leaned in with the man downstairs in that way so that we could sort of set up a larger framework for what it is that we're talking to, because it's just so strange. And I've heard people compare this to sort of cosmic horror, like Lovecraftian kind of like just stuff that's beyond human comprehension. And that's what I was going for. I wanted to take this to a place where you realize like it isn't going to fit into any kind of neat box.
Well, nothing really ever does it? So as I hear you talking about this, and I have a love of science fiction novels and everything science fiction, frankly, but I also, when I read something like your book, I see a relationship between art and science. And I think that there is a strong relationship in many ways, but I was just wondering what you thought about that. What is the relationship between the two?
Patterns, you know, like the more I live, the more I think everything is really just, we're all just sort of these patterns that are existing in reality. And so, I mean, I think that that's what art is just capturing a beautiful pattern. And science is really about finding those patterns and understanding them. And so, you know, that's one thing about the entity is that it's embodied in the environment and in a pattern that is familiar. I'm not going to give it away because it's kind of one of the fun twists towards the end of the book. But I think that, you know, there's research, there's interesting stuff to read about how certain patterns can, so it's like a question of where does consciousness come from? And like, we don't know, right? And in fact, we can't even prove whether other people are conscious. We just each are subjectively assuming. But like, is it the physical structure of us in the world that creates consciousness, or is it coming from somewhere, or like, what is it? And it's just so fun to think about, because that's the thing that would unite us with an entity, right? Like if there's another entity somewhere, or if it's coming here, then the idea would be that we're both conscious, right? And so like, that's kind of where I was playing around a lot with that, and kind of finding the common ground between art and science in terms of patterns.
Yeah, I love that. That's beautiful. I know that you, as a child, you were really into science fiction, and then you decided to go into science because you wrote a lot of short stories, right, when you were a child.
I have, yeah, I've written 30 or 40 short stories. They're all over the place. I have a book of short stories called Guardian Angels and Other Monsters.
But were they ones that you started when you were a kid?
You know, I gave them to my English teacher, and both my English teachers and that I had at Booker T. Washington in Tulsa. Shout out to Booker T. And yeah, they would revise them, or they wouldn't revise them. They would edit. They would like and give me notes, and I'd revise on it and then send it to the magazines. But no, nothing ever got published. And I also kind of realized they were all a bit derivative, right? I was pretty young, and so I was reading a lot, and I was just kind of, you know, spitting stuff back out. And also, I didn't have any emotion in those stories because I hadn't lived, you know, really. Like, and as I get older, the more I realize that it's about the emotion. It's about the humans in your vacation photos, not the beautiful mountains. Like, they're beautiful, but you need to give it some context and some reason to exist. So Yeah, more and more I write about emotion, and I have leaned that way as I get older. I still have those old short stories, though. And when I was in Tulsa promoting to promote this book, my English teacher came to my talk, and Miss Gromberg, it was, as soon as I saw her, I knew exactly who it was. I was like, Miss Gromberg. And so I told her, I started naming all of the books that we read in her class, because I had just bought them for my kids, because I just remember, you know, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, My Name is Asher Lev, Flowers for Algernon, like all these books that she gave me back then. I'm like, they made an impact on me. I want my kids to read those too.
Oh, shout out to Miss Gromberg. That's awesome. I don't know. I had this picture of you. Like, did you build battle bots when you were a kid or things like that?
I programmed video games. And my feeling, I've said this before, but my feeling at the time was like that I was arranging symbols in a computer, and then the computer would compile it, and then like something would happen. And when you write a story, it's the same thing. You're arranging symbols on a page, and then the human brain compiles it, and then something happens. And like, you know, you invoke sort of an experience in someone's head, ideally an emotional one. And so I thought of them as the same thing. I mean, fundamentally, I think it's important that every human being have a way to take what's in their head and put it into the world, to share it with other people or just to express yourself. And so for me, I saw those two things as equivalent. But then I will say, I got a summer job, you know, programming computers, and it was not as romantic as all that. It was sitting in a cubicle under a fluorescent light programming all day, and I was like, man, I can't do this. I gotta stay in school as long as possible before I have to go work.
Yeah, that's a good realization. Totally good realization there. I was just wondering, you said that you, when you were writing in your younger years, who were your influences?
Yeah.
Who were some of your writing mentors, and just by reading them, I guess?
Well, so I was very logical, like I said, and I didn't really believe in myself in terms of being a writer. So I liked Arthur C. Clarke just for the ideas, because I thought, this guy can barely write, but these ideas are amazing, you know?
Oh, no. Arthur C. Clarke,
it's not pretty, right? It's straightforward. He gets to the point. You compare him to someone like Ray Bradbury, where it's like gorgeous. You're like, oh my God, I can taste this. I can smell this. But it's also, you're like, how's he writing about Mars right now? You know, like this is also sort of atmospheric. And so like, you know, Bradbury, Arthur C. Clarke, Asimov, I loved Kurt Vonnegut. I love it's all these people's short stories. So Vonnegut, Philip K. Dick, but you'll notice these are all white men, right? So that's what science fiction was at that time.
It was totally. Yeah.
And so that's what my influences were. You know, Andre Norton, I really loved, and then eventually found out she was female, but again, writing under a male name. And so yeah, those are kind of, that's just a very common murderer's row. The other thing is I would just read these pulp science fiction magazines, you know, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Analog and stuff. And they're just full of people whose names I will never remember, but just short story after short story after short story. And eventually I went back and I realized a lot of Roger Zelazny, I really love. Like, so there's some stuff that I didn't even realize who it was or what was going on. I was just reading to read. And those were my big influences.
When I discovered Octavia Butler, of course, I love mm-hmm. Ursula Le Guin because she's the home girl here, right? Mm-hmm. But when I discovered Octavia Butler, it was just like it changed my whole mind. It was so refreshing. And that was like one of the first. I loved Harlan Ellison a lot. Talk about short story writers.
See, I never did.
Oh, you never did.
I never did. No, Harlan Ellison was too brutal for me.
He was pretty grim. Yeah, he was rough.
Yeah, I couldn't. And then also, there's a lot of, you notice I also didn't mention, oh God, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Well, how am I blanking on? I'm not mentioning, my God, Daniel Heinlein. Because also, I felt like some of these guys were, I just didn't feel like they were very friendly to women at all. Like,
no, there was a lot of that.
And like, even now, you know, like I actually have adapted a Philip K. Dick novel for Electric Shepherd for his children run his production company. I mean, obviously he passed a long time ago, but reading those novels and just reading them, every one of them, you realize like, okay, there's some themes here. Like this guy was really mad at his ex-wife. And so like, you can kind of let it go, but that was kind of a big component of that stuff back then. And that's part of what I really love about the renaissance of science fiction now, is that a lot of people are cracking genre through different sort of cultural perspectives, and I'm here for it. Like, I'm ready.
And opening it up, you know, for a lot of different voices, you know, that have not been heard from, for sure.
Yeah, but the thing is, we all love genre, right? Like, everybody's going to love it when aliens show up. I mean, I do.
I do too.
Everybody's going to love it when the robots start going berserk. Let's do it. Yeah. Awesome. But like, I can only see it from one perspective so many times. And it's like, okay, well, what's going on over there? What's going on with these folks? Like, how would it look from that perspective? And it's great because you just get to keep having so much fun in genre, and it never, you know, it never runs out of fun. So
yeah, I do love aliens, but I also love time travel. I just like to think about that historically. So how you can change things or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, just all the super fun. Chris Nolan does it real well. Like stuff like Interstellar, where he uses time dilation to examine like how much you get to participate in your kid's childhood and stuff. And it's just like, so to me, that's the goal. That's like the golden ring is like being able to invoke that science fiction and at the same time really get that emotion that everybody can relate to, and you know, and then you're bawling while you're watching some cool robots. I mean, there you go. For me, that's what I go for.
Now we've sort of moved into films and movies. There's so much action in A Hole in the Sky, and I'm glad you got a deal with Netflix. I understand that you have other things that are in various stages of development, as they say. But can you tell us a little bit about that? You're going to be executive producing, writing the screenplay, and you have some pretty big names involved.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, yes, it's big name. But Sterling Harjo, yeah. But he's my buddy. So sort of. But so Sterling's from Tulsa. I've known him a long time. And we've sold other stuff together. But you know, when I started thinking of this idea for A Hole in the Sky, and I knew I wanted Oklahoma to be like a character. It's like, it's a big part of the book. And so I started talking to Sterling about it. And I was like, he's like, I would love to direct that movie. Let's do it. So he and I talked a lot. We went to Spiro. We walked the mounds. You know, it was so hot, we nearly died. it's Oklahoma. And so we went out and we sold it to Netflix. We have a company called Aggregate. That's Jason Bateman's production company that's producing. So I'm attached to, Sterling's attached to direct it, which I'm super excited about. And I'm attached to write it. So I have written the first draft and I've just gotten my rewrite notes from Sterling and from everybody and Netflix. And so, yeah, I'm in the middle of it, but it's really nice because I finished the novel. It's done. It came out. It really represented like my vision for what I wanted that novel to be. And then now I'm getting to kind of go back and play with all these ideas that I love, and also just completely take advantage of Sterling's genius and like take all of his great ideas and then mash it up into this sort of new version of something I already love that's made for film. And so it's been super exciting. It's super fun. I have written a lot of screenplays. I've sold a lot of screenplays. I haven't had any of them produced. And so this, I'm hoping, you know, will be the one, because it would be so much fun to go back to Oklahoma and hang with Sterling and see this thing get made.
I read something where you were talking with Sterling and you're looking at the mounds and going, oh, we need to build bigger mounds or something.
Yeah, yeah, we were walking the mounds and he was like, these are a little flat. And I'm like, I know, we're going to have to get some stunt mounds in here. These are a little flat. But like, you know, but like the visitor center and just Spiro itself. I mean, it's just south of the Arkansas River. It's just a very specific part of Oklahoma. That's just like all the churches and are on every corner, like, you know, one stoplight, and just, it's such an interesting little slice of Americana there.
Well, there's something about mounds, you know, there's so much history, and there's something about Bear Mountains too. I'm thinking of the Painted Hills and John Day, you know, there's something about that just feels so ancient that, you know, that you're just so, I don't know. I felt like I wanted to cry, you know, when I've seen them. And I've seen some in Europe too, of all things, like, you know, I'm thinking of the Tor in Salisbury. There's just something about that that has so much history and so much, I don't know, so much pull spiritually, I think, that you're really connected to it.
It's hard to put a finger on what it is, but it's definitely there. You know, you feel it when you're there. You feel it at Spiro for sure. Like, part of it, I think, is because you know, these places are so embodied in where they're at. And those mounds are put there so purposefully. They're, you know, they're there and they're still there for a reason. And so that you're seeing the same environment that the people that were there before see. And so there is this sort of through line in that it's not something that you can pick up and carry around. It's not like an artifact. It's like, it's there. The place is the thing. And the embodiment is the reason. And they went there every day for generations, you know? And so if you grow up in a place like that, if you have that in your backyard, you're participating in that. You're just like the latest generation to be participating in that environment. And so I think that's what's special about it. I think there's a lot of impetus for people to fly around the world and visit things and check it off and take a picture of it. But there's something really special about, hey, here in Oregon, you know, the rivers, going to a place every week, 52 weeks out of the year, doing it for 10 years and realizing like it's different every time and starting to realize those patterns that you can't get from like an Instagram picture. Like it's like patterns that reveal themselves to you over years and years. And you have to earn them, I guess. And I'm a big believer in that. It's one thing I love about Oregon and getting out in the country.
You sound busier than ever. Are you thinking about another book? What's in the back of your head here?
Yeah, I'm writing a couple scripts right now. And yeah, I'm always thinking about another book. I mean, Robopocalypse has been with Amblin and with Steven Spielberg for like since 2011 or something. And believe it or not, it is still going. They're still writing new scripts. And so that is, believe it or not, that's still something that's on my mind a lot, thinking about what's going to happen with that next. So yeah, but I don't have any definitive anything I could share at this moment about a future book that I'm writing right now. But I know a lot of people want me to write the trilogy of Robopocalypse. There's a sequel, Robogenesis.
Oh, okay.
And I fully intend to do that. Yeah. And especially if anything happens with that, with the movie, of course, I will immediately dive into it. But, and then in terms of like writing more Crichton stuff, people are interested in that too. And I just don't know about that. I just have too many of my own ideas that was such a fun experience to play in Crichton's sandbox. You know? It's also sort of very scary and kind of a tightrope. So we'll see. I mean, I haven't run out of ideas, so I'll be busiest.
You go where the doors open, right? You just go through the door and see what happens. I am, on a personal level, I'm very curious of how you're going to handle the aliens in this film, because I just feel that's so monumental.
Well, I will tell you, just to tease, you know, one of Sterling's big influences is this movie called Stalker, which is an adaptation of a novel called Roadside Picnic by the Strugatsky brothers. And it's pretty trippy. it gets pretty trippy.
I have not seen that movie.
Well, it's more of an art movie. I mean, it's not, I don't know that it's some sort of on Space Odyssey 2001 level in terms of a crowd pleaser. So.
Wow. So it will be probably unexpected what you might envision.
But that's just sort of an inspiration in terms of visuals and stuff like that.
That's so fascinating. Well, I wish you just good positive vibes as you go on this journey to making this film and the other film with Steven Spielberg, which we hope will happen as well. And it will happen when it needs to, right? So yeah, you're in a good spot right now.
Yeah, I got no complaints. I'm having a great time. I wake up and I write science fiction every day. So, I mean, I have no problem with that.
And this was your dream when you were a kid.
It really was. I mean, I had to take a detour and study real science for a minute. I mean, God, you know, luckily, okay, it all worked out. So,
well, yeah. The real science, you had some pretty great experiences with the real science too, you know?
Oh, I did. I mean, no, I'm just kidding. That's amazing stuff.
So I wish you the best for the holiday. Oh, I do have one more question. What is you said you based your relationship, not based it, but Jim and Tawny, the father and the teenage daughter. Did your teenager read your book and that part of it?
Oh, my teenager won't read my book. I keep trying to get them to read it, and it has not worked out.
Okay.
But yeah, so it's a point of contention in the house. my middle schooler wants to read it, and I'm like, I don't know. I'm in the incommunicado phase of the teenage years right now, where dad's not cool. Dad's not cool, so... But someday,
okay,
they'll come around.
You're living that, yeah. Someday. All right. Well, Daniel H. Wilson, thank you for taking the time for this.
Sure.
And you can find out more info about A Hole in the Sky available on all bookselling platforms and also at danielhwilson.com. And I have that link and more info as well as this podcast on stageandstudio.org or orartswatch.org. That's it for Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. Till the next conversation, I'm Dimelo Roberts. And we're out.
Cool. All right. That was awesome. Thank you.